Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The Film Department of the Museum of Modern Art and the Library Extension Division, the New York State Library, take great pleasure in welcoming you to an evening with Professor Marshall McLuhan and his associates. The first speaker on the program tonight is an ex-academic, and as he phrases it, in another embodiment, a student of the Middle Ages and a Chaucerian scholar. He's collaborating with Tony Schwartz and Marshall McLuhan on an educational project that will deal with non-print perceptual training at the grammar and high school levels. He hopes that the patterns first being tried this evening are an augury of many more such combinations to come, first with Tony Schwartz and then with other top explorers of the media. May I present Dr. Ralph Baldwin.
I'm going to take a few minutes to introduce our few principals, and then Marshall McLuhan will come on, Tony Schwartz thereafter, an ensuing dialogue, and then Marshall to tidy up perhaps, answer questions, and respond as you would like him. Most of you, I am sure, are familiar with Marshall McLuhan through one or more of his three books, The Mechanical Bride, The Gutenberg Galaxy, and Understanding Media. And they are now being recognized as three of the most sourceful and resourceful books of our time in the field of communication and information. You know him then as literateur, aesthetician, critic, and social commentator. And as such, he needs no introduction. But when I asked myself recently just what he is up to, what discipline or disciplines he is reporting to, and what his role in the current scene might be, I found an answer I would like to share with you, if indeed it may not have occurred to some of you already. Are you familiar with ecology? A recent book on ecology, that is a science that occupies itself with the living organism and its surroundings, that studies the balance of nature and the habitat of flora and fauna in the same locale or region. This book said, and I suddenly realized when I read this that Marshall McLuhan is an ecologist of man-made environments. This book said that ecology in the next 10 or 20 years may very well become the most popular of sciences, a household word to those masses who today are ignorant, both of the word and its meaning. If the ecology of nature is, relatively speaking, a latecomer to the sciences and thereby unexplored, the ecology of art, of the human artifact, is a world even more unknown. And I suppose, to be a little romantic about it, its reconnaissance man, its conquistador, is Marshall McLuhan. 2 points should be made, then, on this proposal. First, that after Harold Innes' work some 25 years ago at the University of Toronto, McLuhan is the first and virtually the only one to give the subject matter serious attention. And next, that if disruptions, renewals, breakthroughs, reversals, catastrophes, and flurowits occur in the order of nature and its ecology, then the order of art and its ecology, given man's intelligence, emotion, imagination, and creativity, is even more precariously suspended in time and space. In a few minutes, then, here to give us some notion of the terrain, the specimens, the imminent developments, and the future topography of our man-made environments will be Marshall McLuhan. A word about his collaborator this evening, Tony Schwartz. Tony Schwartz has been doing in the field of sound what Marshall McLuhan has been theorizing about in all the media. Tony has said many times that McLuhan has given him his own practice and experiment with sound recording, a theoretical support, a directive rationale, and a reassurance that as he plays with his medium, like any good artist, He is working meaningfully and productively at the moving edges of his art. Because with Steichen, the great photographer who said of Tony Schwartz that he was the first to raise sound recording into the realm of the arts. And it is the practicing artists like Tony and the various media who find in Marshall McLuhan a goad, an excitement, a stimulus, and they hope a confirmation. This is the felicitous merger here, I would say tonight, then, of the theorist critic McLuhan and the artist practitioner Schwartz, wherein Tony is beginning concretely and dramatically to corroborate some of Marshall's insights, to confirm in sound and film the exciting and seminal discoveries made by Marshall McLuhan, and to formulate these into the working credo of the artist in sound who puts them to use in all that he touches and trades in. From the TV and radio commercials, he has done some 900 of them, to the adventure in art form that Tony is composing now in what he calls a sonomontage, a presentation in sound of some of the highlights of Steichen's famous album, The Family of Man. The first notice I had read of Tony Schwartz called him, with warm praise, a fanatic in sound. This, I object, is a misnomer, no matter how well-intentioned. A fanatic is one who has lost his balance, who has fallen into frenetic preoccupation with a cause or a concern. Tony is an enthusiast, yes, and he probes, thrusts, and experiments like Marshall. But he has, I tell you, a sureness of control, an arbitration of taste, and that last detachment of the artist that knows implacably how to accept and to reject what he has finished, no matter how cherished it was in the making. Tony is, I would say, an ecologist in the world of sound. Now that's the brief introduction to the partnership we are about to see unfold here this evening. Marshall will come on first, and then Tony. Marshall, McLuhan.
Well, I'm going to mention that Ralph Baldwin and I are doing a book on media that concerns a very special aspect of them, and that it has a rather amusing side. It's called A Message to the Fish because, as a friend of ours once said, we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. And for people who are profoundly involved in various environments, professions, activities, these are the people for whom The Message to the Fish is designed as a kind of reorientation, awakening. And so I'm going to begin this little teamwork tonight with another, to me, very delightful and useful anecdote that concerns Tony Schwartz. He was once advised by a policeman in New York 19, where he lives, and the area that he has glorified by that wonderful sound portrait, that if ever you're in trouble, don't shout for help. Shout fire. Now, this is, of course, a profound insight into the difference between the hot and the cold. The cop had a complete intuition of these, of the different media. You see, when you shout help, people know that somebody's in trouble, and if they go around there, they might get involved in depth. That is why the strange reluctance of people in our time to help people who shout for help. Whereas if you shout fire, this is impersonal, detached, non-involved. You can rush in without any danger of involvement, just or phone the fire department or do something without any involvement, whatever. But if you answer a cry for help, you might get profoundly involved. It might change your whole life. And people are already so profoundly involved in our new kind of culture that they just soon find some way out.
And anyway, Tony, I'm very grateful to Tony for this little true story about the hot and the cold. And it really throws a lot of light. Many people find difficulty in understanding the difference between hot and cold media, and Tony's going to show you a few of those differences. I will mention, since the theme tonight is film, I will mention right off that film is a hot medium as compared to TV. Therefore, it has much less power to involve the whole man than TV, or involve in the sense of drag people into its parlor, as it were. But James Joyce devotes parts of the Finnegan's Wake to film and TV, and he explains his approach to film is in the section called The Aunt and the Grasshopper. The Aunt is a motor car, and the Grasshopper is an airplane. And The Aunt is the film and the Grasshopper is TV. Now, I'll just mention why they happen to pop up in that illustrative role. Joyce, I think, quite correctly saw that the motor car is very much like a movie camera, with the driver really in charge of screen and the camera alike, and having a moving picture on his own. The driver of a motor car is by way of being a movie unit. Now, this isn't true of airplane. But the motor car extends the feet of man. The driver of a motor car is a kind of paraplegic, very much like someone seated in a movie theater looking at the great screen, the great environment outdoors. And the movie is an extension of the human eyes, the eyes extended prodigiously by means of the feet. Actually, in biologically or physiologically, the eyes are on a platform provided by the feet. The feet, I mean, the physiologists put it somewhat in those terms, that man's eyes are provided with a mobile moving platform of feet. And the fish are in a somewhat different position with regard to the use of the eye. But the movie, as an extension of feet and eye, is very different from TV, which is really an extension of the whole body. And the TV camera is much more an extension of the hand than it is of the feet or the eyes. The TV scanning finger actively moves through and over objects. And the TV camera has really very few characteristics in common with the movie camera. It has no shutter. It doesn't take pictures. And it handles the human environment. Moreover, the TV viewer is the screen, not the camera. The movie viewer is camera. His eyes go out at the world. The movie viewer looks at the world, which is enormously extended, enlarged, and made available to him. The TV viewer does not look at the world. It looks at him. He is the screen. The TV I'm saying, of course, that between the movie and the TV form, there is a profound antithesis, a profound opposition. And whereas the TV viewer is the screen, with the image coming at him, in Joyce's phrase, which he uses throughout the whole of Finnegan's Wake, the TV viewer receives the charge of the light brigade. He is the valley of death, as it were. And the TV tube is a charge of light particles that literally and physically move at the audience and cover you. Those little dots on the screen move onto you. Those little particles of light invest the viewer and wrap around him. The TV viewer is wrapped up in the space of the TV image, which goes around him. And in becoming the environment, instead of being detached as the movie viewer is, and looking at an environment, in becoming an environment, the TV viewer, and this is true of all our youngsters since TV, feels profoundly part of the world. This amazing sophistication and sense of belonging to the world and feeling at home in all parts of the world, which is characteristic of those children for whom TV was an early experience, who had TV long before they learned to read and write. In my own family, there's a profound difference between the children who learned to read and write before TV and those who learned to read and write after TV. They have completely different habits of mind and social association. The children who learn to read and write after TV are in a much more profound group, much more serious, grim, if you like. The TV generation of youngsters is grim. They're not lighthearted. They're not playful. They're not detached. They have none of the fantasy of the old movie world or the old book world about them. They're deeply involved. They take everything very seriously. And, including a lot of things that would be better to be handled more playfully. I'm not trying to make value judgments here. I'm not trying to say that the TV is good or bad or the movie is good or bad. I'm just trying to make a distinction between their mode of operation. And Joyce has this fascinating section. It's in the Thunder number 9 of Finnegan's Wake that he deals with the Owned and the Grace Hopper. Then in Thunder number 10 on page 424, he goes straight over to TV and deals with the TV world as such. It's the last thunder in the book. The thunders, by the way, in Finnegan's Wake, are moments of huge technological innovation and impact on society. The thunder is the rumble of social change, response to new technology in the whole human society. The thunder is simply the kind of world applause or response to novelty and innovation. And there are 10 of these thunders, each one of which is very carefully worked out in terms of things like motor cars and telegraphs and television and movies. Now, the TV as plane is much more, you see, an airplane is not the extension of the feet or the hands, it's an extension of the entire body simultaneously. And that's why it brings it very much closer to TV than it does to movie. All technologies, whatever, are extensions of our own physiology and our own sensory life. Naturally, when you extend these forms into the environment and make environments out of them, it has a profound effect on the rest of our makeup. Now, the artists of the later 19th century gave us a sort of preview of this coming change, whereas the photograph tended to scare artists away from realistic representation of the world. The coming of electric technology was felt in the artist's radar system, as it were, and a man like Seurat, or Rouault, responded by creating a new visual form in painting that is called illusion, or, as in the case of Rouault, painting on stained glass with the light coming through the object rather than light on object. And both of these painters were very much aware that if you want to create a huge involvement on the part of the audience, you must do that. You must have rear light, rear projection. You must have the light coming through the object at the viewer rather than having the light falling on the object and the viewer looking at the object. In Seurat, in pointillism, which is a form of TV, Seurat was painting TV long before there was any TV in prospect. That is, in 1880, he was painting TV. He was painting this rear projection, all these little dots. He was explicitly and consciously seeking to involve his reader in depth in the making process. The object of the artist in the later 19th century was to involve the viewer or the audience in the making process. Edgar Allan Poe hit upon this with his detective story technique. He discovered that if you leave out all the connections in a story, the reader becomes profoundly involved in making them and in completing the story. The technique of the simplest poem in the detective story of leaving things out creates huge involvement. TV leaves out most information. It's a very cool medium with very little data provided in the image. The engineers say, the information engineers say, in a photograph, there's very little information but much data, meaning by information they mean form. They say, on the other hand, in TV, there is much information and very few data. That is, in the TV image, there are not very many data, but there's lots of structure, lots of outline, lots of pattern. It's cartoon form. It's iconic. Just a crude, rough image compared to the photograph. Now, when an image is rough and crude, like a storyboard in an advertising agency, there is profound involvement. When you polish it up, fill it in, complete it, then the viewer has no possibility of involvement. He's just left outside looking at a completed image. So paradoxically, TV creates much involvement because it provides so little in the way of data. The movie creates much less involvement because it's a much better image, provides far more data, leaves the viewer outside enjoying the image in a relative detachment. There are many popular misconceptions about this, but I won't try to deal with them now. We'll perhaps have a question period or a question and answer period at the end. Now, since Tony Schwartz is going to illustrate precisely some of these intermedia dialogue differences, is going to reveal some of the strange things that media do to us when they get out into our world, I think that is the this is the right place at which to bring him up here, and I will retire for a few minutes, or for half an hour, while Tony illustrates some of these kinds of points much better than I could do. Tony Schwartz. Thanks, and congratulations on that fine show, Tony. You can see one of the advantages of this approach is that it enables everybody in this room, everybody anywhere, to become a real discoverer. When you set up different situations in which people can sharpen their perceptions, anybody can make discoveries. Children can make discoveries as profound as adults. Oppenheimer is fond of saying, Bob Oppenheimer, there at kids playing here on the sidewalk could solve some of my toughest problems in physics because they have modes of perception that I lost 40 years ago. Discovery is often and mainly a matter of perception. Most of our perceptions are blocked by earlier perceptions of which we're completely unaware. There are a couple of points that Tony made that I just wanted to refer to for a moment. The Bosco ad reminded me that Sacro Bosco is the word for Hollywood. It means Hollywood. It's the Latin form of Hollywood. But Sacro Bosco is also a place in Scotland from which Hollywood had its name. And it's a way of tying in then with the great theme now of our occasion. Now, Tony, I would suggest there is such a thing as black and white sound, but it means chiaroscuro, black and white chiaroscuro, that gradation of light and shade, creates perspective, creates visual space. Chiaroscuro in sound means a crescendo, gradual modulation of sound. For example, in the film of Dr. Zhivago, if you may have noticed, there is no black and white sound. There are just the violent encounters of strong colors. Ruskin called the chord of color without chiaroscuro. There's no build-up. If anything happens in Zhivago, there's no build-up to the sound effect. It is immediate. It's like the comic book Pow, Zam, and so on. That there's no black and white in the comic book effect. It's iconic. Icon means the encounter of one surface with another surface direct. And in black and white gradations in music or in the other arts, you have the exact opposite of that encounter. And so the black and white sound is just a useful point at which to resume this world briefly, this world of the film and its relation to other forms. There's an old story you've probably heard before about two goats that were chomping on an old batch of films that had been thrown out behind an MGM studio in Hollywood. And one of the goats kicked open an old tin that held a picture of Gone with the Wind and sort of signaled to his neighbor to, come on, try some of this. When his pal came along and nibbled a bit of Gone with the Wind, the first one said, how do you like that? After a little meditation, the other one said, oh, well, I think I like the book better. That's not intended as a profound insight into the into the media, but it's somewhat like the sort of insights one often hears. The speaking of the Charge of the Light Brigade as a TV form involving us in ourselves, one of the strange effects of TV, of course, is to drive us inward. The TV generation is a depth-oriented generation, and if there's any value in depth and profundity, we're going to get it from the TV generation as never before. I think there's something to be said for the world of Mae West and Harold Lloyd as well. A little playfulness, a little coonskinism in the way of frivolity, playfulness, and so on has its advantages over profundity at times. But the Aqualung people, you see, are unwitting victims of TV, and all the underwater divers are trying to simulate TV environments which they can have much less expense at home in front of the TV set. The TV viewer is a sort of underwater diver. He lives in an element of total submersion and total involvement that is of low definition, very low visual quality. I have heard skin divers arguing bitterly about the desecration of the underwater landscape by irresponsible skin divers who, not like the old complaints about tourists who left tin cans and things around in public places. You know, there's now developing a league to protect underwater landscapes from the desecration of travelers and tourists. And so it's quite a novel form of complaint. There's another story I've heard recently that helps with some aspects of media. It concerns Mel Rowe, the Minister of Culture for de Gaulle, taking de Gaulle on a tour of an art gallery. And as they move through various paintings, de Gaulle would say, and what's that one? Ah, says Mel Rowe, that is a Dufy. Mm-hmm. And that one? Ah, that is a Renoir. Then de Gaulle brightened up. As they moved on a little further, he said, uh-huh, I see that monstrous-looking cartoon effect over there. That must be a Rouault. No, sir, said Monroe, that is a mirror. This is to reveal the strange results of light through as compared to light on. It's not intended as derogatory to anybody, whatever. One of the amazing dimensions of film, as it was reflected in the novel, was stream of consciousness. Cinema, or moving images, when translated into prose, produced this quite a wonderful effect, stream of consciousness. And the stream of consciousness writers discovered to their surprise that the reader could get far more empathy, involvement in the mental processes of characters by disconnected, broken shots than they could by simple storyline interpretation. This is still a mystery. That is, the relation of stream of consciousness to the developing movie technologies is also an area that is richly illustrated in symbolist poetry, and I find it useful sometimes in teaching Mr. Eliot's poetry to point out how the proof rock world is very much a Charlie Chaplin sort of comedy. And with the shots are very much in the style of early silence, and with a sort of jazz effect. Mr. Eliot is from St. Louis and brought the blues to Britain, to British poetry. There again, a very curious thing, speaking of light and shade and sound. The blues, as a form of involving, are famous. And if you have a bright, smart, cheerful, or any kind of melody completely tied in, it is a much less effective means of involving people than syncopation with its breaks and discontinuities which compel people to fill them in. The blues permits this direct encounter of forms, like syncopation itself. Instead of a nice, smooth, melodic line, you have these abrupt interruptions which permit far more involvement. The world of Mozart is a very pictorial world in musical terms. That is, there's much light and shade in it, and much foreground and background and perspective. Many of the spaces in Mozartian music are arranged just exactly like a Fragonard painting or a Boucher painting. You can have spaces, visual spaces, introduced into music. Auditory space is a very fascinating type of space, quite different from visual space. And this ties in with this matter of storyline. Visual space is continuous and connected. Anything that causes visual space to be upgraded in a culture will cause also respect for unity and continuity and connectedness. Anything that, this is true only of the visual sense, the other senses don't have this built-in characteristic of unity, connectedness, uniformity, and so on. There is no uniformity or connectedness in hearing or in touch. As Alec Layton put it, to the blind, all things are sudden. Blind people don't have a sense of uniform, continuous space. They live in a world of abrupt discontinuities and insights. The ancient world had the blind man always as the very type of the seer, the sage, the insight man. Because his being deprived of the merely visual sense, he was in a position to plunge depth insights into situations. Well, the world of the stream of consciousness is very much in debt in the novel and in poetry to the movie form. And one thing that I would like to add to Tony's observations about the tape recorder, it has made us very conscious of sounds in our environment of which we are ordinarily unconscious. John Cage has a definition of silence in which he says, silence consists of all those sounds that are unintended. All the unintended sounds in the environment constitute silence. And it is the unintended sounds in the environment that the tape recorder and such instruments can now put right into the concert hall. This is why this happened with the photograph when it was new. The photograph brought images into the popular press, magazines, that images of things in the human environment of which people were completely unaware. The one thing that people do not see is their environment. They see the previous environment, not the actual wild. Anyway, with the photograph, people began to notice the actual state of their cities, their yards, their homes, their houses, their clothing, the way they looked, for the first time, say a century ago. And just as the tape recorder is brought into our environment, the sounds that are unintended brought into the concert hall, so the photograph brought into the world of direct attention and inspection a whole world of images that people ordinarily ignored. Now, one of the effects of the tape recorder, you can see, is to compel people to regard the sound environment as a work of art. Many electric tendencies in our environment today encourage people to begin to think about the possible programming of the human environment as if it were a work of art. Instead of worrying about what you put inside art galleries, taking a direct approach to the environment itself as a work of art. The Balinese have a saying, we have no art, we do everything as well as possible. They're quite aware of the fact that the Westerner regards art as a sometime thing that can be put into a special little space while the rest of the environment can be just anything. However, to get back onto our movie track and get off this wild track for a moment, the movie has noticeably become much more of an art form in popular and even erudite estimation since TV. Since TV, movie is the old environment, TV goes around it as new environment, movie goes up as art form. Yes, it's really very noticeable that since TV, movie has become art form. Old silence, old movies of any sort are now cherished and regarded with new awe and reverence. And this has happened over and over again in the human past. Every time a new form goes around an old form, the old form becomes an art form. It's like old coach lamps, old buggies, old Model Ts, old anything. They all become art forms. It's like Williamsburg. The Williamsburg treatment of old environments as if they were works of art. Now that the planet has a new environment, a man-made environment of satellites and electric information, you can depend upon it that the planet is itself going to become an art form. That old nose cone, that old spacecraft, our planet, our human habitat, is going to be tidied up with vast expenditure of thought and energy as the place where it all began. The old habitat to which one can return occasionally on a pilgrimage. Well, there's strong evidence of this as occurring already. One of the observations that comes to mind that has been made about sound, when sound came to film, photograph, when the photograph suddenly had a soundtrack put on it around it, when radio was put around film, the effect of sound on images was extraordinary, and it, as you remember perhaps, was very disrupting. It caused much heartburn and heartache and much tossing out of old stars, John Gilbert's and so on, because the radio image is a hot image, the photograph is a hot image, and when those two hot images get together, they do things to each other. They compel the movie camera to become a much more high-fire, much more precise. One of the reasons for the charm of the old silence is that they're so lo-fi. They're very much like TV, which is real lo-fi. The silence are closer to TV, well, so is Batman, so are the comics, than they are to movies. And one of the observations that has been made about the coming of sound to movies was that instead of just presenting a sequence or story in a series of pictures, the tendency of sound was to cause the camera to dwell on each shot in depth and to include the whole story, as it were, in each shot. The shot became inclusive rather than exclusive. And this compelled all sorts of subtle mastery of form that was a considerable strain on the industry. I think you might say that it knocked some countries right out of the movie business, partly because of the vast new expense of sound and the new virtuosity needed for photography. And some of the leading countries in film production were knocked right out of the business. They didn't have the resources. However, that's merely incidental. Since TV, however, there has been much weakening of the storyline in film. TV is not a narrative medium. It doesn't need narratives. The individual shot is very inclusive, just like a cartoon. A cartoon is not a picture, and it has no point of view. It includes all possible points of view in each cartoon. Dagwood or Lil Abner or anybody, each cartoon is complete. It's total. It's the whole image of that person in all his possible modalities. This isn't true of photography. Photography is highly specialist. It selects an aspect, a moment in the life of the thing. The cartoon does not select a moment in the life of the thing, and the photograph does. The movie does. And this high selectivity in time, just the isolated moment, creates a very strange world. Storyline is very helpful and needful in film when it uses hi-fi photography. But in lo-fi, as in a Chaplin, the need for intense connectedness is much smaller. In TV, the need for connectedness is much less than in movie, for the same reason, and the viewer can fill in at liberty many of the connecting missing bits. In the case of the influence of TV on movies, it might, I expect it might be illustrated by the sudden growth of the interest in the vogue for Dr. Zhivago's, Fellini's, Bergman's, in which storyline is rather incidental and insignificant compared to the mood, the mode, the modulation and variation of single situations and images. This variation of theme, of mode, is taking the place of storyline since TV. And I think you will find that our children, the TV generation, are not nearly so interested in narrative or storyline, whether in library form or in film form, as their older brothers and sisters. The loss of interest in narrative and the sudden upgrading of facts, you know, the romance shows, the thing novel, the research novel, the sudden interest in just raw data in cold blood, in place of story. And again, going with this, no interest in point of view. The angle is not important. The reviewers of Capote's In Cold Blood were puzzled in some cases, and some observed that the murderer probably was the author, or alternatively, the reader. It couldn't have been those people in Kansas. Now, this, again, a very confusing behavior on the part of our young, this indifference to ordinary responsibility and ordinary cause and effect in the older connected sense, storyline sense, this sense of involvement is so great that they no longer are too concerned about who done it or why. And this kind of involvement is almost an Oriental thing, I think, in the case of the TV generation. It goes along with a considerable loss of the sense of identity, or a considerable loss of any feeling of importance attaching to identity. As you know, the existentialists have long urged that what we call our personal or private identity is really just a kind of visa or classification, arbitrary set of data which have a rather incidental relation to anybody. But this mood, I'm not trying to argue a case here, I'm simply pointing to this change of mood, and this loss of sense of identity is perhaps in its most extreme form manifested in the LSD and the drug, the sort of crazes, where people deliberately scrub off the tape of personal awareness. I want to, having just made that kind of tour, I want to point out one of the strange things about the movie when it was new, the beginning of the century. It seemed hilarious, it seemed comic, simply because it was so perfect a repeat of ordinary experience, ordinary living. It became, the movie in its early phase was a parody of life, an imitation of life in a comic sense, because it just went along parahadas against or along beside the track of real life. The picture track, the movie picture track, and the track of real life were almost interchangeable, and this creates a very comic effect. Realism, when new, is comic. Hilarious. Go back to the days of Sam Peeps and Daniel Defoe, and you will see what I mean. But with the coming of realism, prose realism, it was a new mythic form that created a very comic and satiric world. This was the great age of satire. Realistic forms created a comic and satiric effect in the case of Pepys, Diary, and in the case of Defoe, Robinson Crusoe sort of thing. One of the reviewers of Robinson Crusoe said, "Mr. Defoe has represented the British Isles as totally depopulated." This I found a very valuable and comical sidelight on the effect of realism on people for whom realism was new. They couldn't...
Okay, that's the end of the recording.
Private initiative of entrepreneurial enterprise.
Start that over again.
Valerie, the symbolist, private initiative and entrepreneurial enterprise. The Valerie, the symbolist poet, said of the movie, "It is the complete, perfect, mechanical form of memory, visual memory." This is a fascinating and startling insight, to think of the movie as a form of memory storage. Now, anybody can see the book in that form. There's a certain sense in which the book is a storage system. The movie as a storage system, a visual storage system, a visual memory, points straight toward the computer as a storage system which takes on all the senses. The movie, though, as a visual, complete visual memory, terrified people in 1900 because it seemed to rob them of all their natural mental functions. The world of circuitry, of electric circuits, takes people profoundly inside themselves, is a kind of entropic world. It folds us in. It creates a thing like the safety car. The safety car is the car turning in upon itself entropically, and entropy, you know, is the law of declining energies. The entropy turning inward upon itself, the safety car becomes a padded cell for maniacs to drive it. And most people, you know, are inclined to say when they hear about the safety car, "But wouldn't anybody in a safety car go berserk? Wouldn't he just bump into everybody and everything?" Isn't that a strange reaction? It's like the old, you remember the old bump cars at the circuses? Some people tend to regard the safety car as a bump car in which you can really behave as if you're in a Sherman tank and you can just go rip-roaring around, knocking everybody helter-skelter. The tendency then of the movie to become a kind of iconic form at first and then gradually a hi-fi, high-definition form leads me to just say a word or two about the rise of the visual, because the movie represented our Western world going into very top gear visual life, and now with TV we've slipped into very low gear visual life with a resulting change of psychosomatic adjustment and change of mood. But I just want to say a couple of things, especially with an audience like this interested both in the book and film and other forms. I just wanted to draw your attention to this aspect, that the work of people like Innes and Havelock, Havelock's preface to Plato's Sort of Volume, and the work of Barfield in a book called Saving the Appearances have drawn attention to the fact that with the rise of phonetic literacy, with the coming of phonetic literacy, people got a detachment from the world that the old native societies never were able to achieve. Phonetic literacy, by pushing up visual life into high intensity, gave people a form of detachment that was absolutely new in human history. It created the civilized man, the detribalized individual. And subsequent improvements in writing and printing and bookmaking intensified that detachment. Talking about the medium as the message or the massage. If you live in an intensely visual world, you learn the habits of civilized detachment. If you live in an intensely auditory and tactile world, you learn the habits of empathy and involvement. But Havelock describes in a most impressive way the stages by which the Greeks moved out of the world of Homer, the auditory poetic world, into the world of Plato and the visual classification of ideas and data. This is now presumably a tape that is being played backwards. We are now rapidly, thanks to electronic technology, moving from the world of Plato back to the world of Homer. From the world of intense visual classification back to the world of intense auditory involvement. We are easily confused on these issues because they are very complicated issues. For example, it's easy to say, and perhaps true to say, an artist never works because he uses all his faculties all the time, and that's play. When a person is using all of his faculties, all his senses, he's playing. He's creating. When you're making out your income tax or adding up figures, you're using only a small part of your faculties. That's work. In other words, the fragmented man works, the integral man plays. A child is creative until he learns to read and write. Children are all geniuses until the age of 5 or 6 because they're using all their faculties simultaneously. Then they learn to specialize and separate their faculties and become civilized. It's not simple, is it? It's not all one thing or another thing. I think perhaps possibly there may be means eventually of an orchestration of these faculties, an orchestration of media, so that they will not batter each other to bits and batter us to bits. To come back to storyline for a moment, Aristotle's famous remark in the Poetics about plots, and his remark, for example, that of all plots, the episodic are the worst, was referring to a very strange discovery in the Greek day, namely that if you began to take happenings, events, and tie them together in a line or a sequence, you could get a plot. Now, in actual fact, events never are tied together. They all happen simultaneously in real life, and most events are coincidental and overlay each other, and therefore they have no plot-like character whatever. To an Aristotle in his time, when visual life and visual order was new, the tying of things together in a sequence was a dazzling discovery of visual order. And so with the dropping down of visual level, the need for plot and the desire for plot also drops down. And you'll find very little of it in Fellini or Bergman or the Zhivago type of film. But to stay for a moment with the visual world as it came to us and eventually reached the high level of movie, with the coming of Gutenberg technology, the handwritten manuscript went up into very hi-fi form. The old manuscript was called, for example, textura, meaning tapestry. To a medieval eye, there was very little difference between a tapestry and a handwritten page. So they called it textura. And when it went up into hi-fi visuality with Gutenberg repeatable type, it lost all that textura. The page lost the involvement of the reader. The reader became a detached spectator of the page. Silent reading became possible for the first time in the world. You can't have silent reading until you have printing, just as you can't have grammatical errors until you have writing. This is literally true. A child never makes a mistake in slang. No child ever made a grammatical mistake in the use of slang because, on the other hand, if he had to write it down or if teacher had to write it down, they'd both make mistakes in slang at once. Translating from the auditory to the visual form is very tricky. Very few people can accomplish it without slips. The bad speller, for example, is often a poet, a genius. People who of high auditory orientation are very poor spellers. The IQ testers pay no attention to this fact. However, this business of Gutenberg visuality, stepping out things up to high intensity, made it possible for the first time in human history for the whole of society to become a rear-view mirror with a historical perspective backwards. In the 16th century, what we call modern history was born, and the rear-view mirror of life became a major fact. Everybody began to look backward, whether it was at the primitive church or at the wrongs done to his private family. Hamlet is a nice example of the rearview mirror. Here's a man totally alienated from the present world, look on this picture and on that, who was absolutely obsessed with the past events in his life. Oh, what a noble mind is here, Othro. He's a man in a mirror, looking at the past, incapable of coping with the present. Much of the art of his time was likewise, whether it was the Greek mythology being illustrated by painters or the mirror for magistrates with moral tales of evil deeds done in the past by virtuous men. All rearview mirror. But the great example of it is Paradise Lost, in which the whole of the human condition is used as a rearview mirror to get a view of the Garden of Eden. This is a fantastic achievement. It tends to dwindle away a bit from that point into what is called a little later, the graveyard school of poetry, where people wandered around graveyards in order to meditate upon the human past, on mute and glorious Milton's and Cromwell's guiltless of their country's blood. But using the graveyard as a rearview mirror became a great artistic pastime. It ended suddenly with the Newtonian discovery of the world as a mental mirror, the whole world as a mirror of the mind of man. The Romantics dropped history and began simply to meditate on the mirror of the human mind that was lay in the external page of nature. Now, this was stepping up the visual intensity of civilization a great deal, and photograph and film came not too long afterwards. And in them, the rearview mirror became very strong. You may have noticed that the Victorian novels all begin back 30, 40 years before the publication date of the book. They all were rearview mirrors. And nobody knows why. And no, it wasn't even noticed at the time. But the novels of Scott and Dickens and everybody all start back 30 years before the publication date, just as a matter of course. The idea, again, of giving the world as it is right now came in much more with photo and with film. And with the rise of photographic realism, the novelist, too, was affected, just as the painter was. The painter tended to turn more towards structural forms, and the novelist turned more towards structure and turned the novel more and more into poem. Flaubert created the first novel poems. A novel, like Madame Bovary, is a poem in the sense that it is a simultaneous order. Everything that happens, happens at once and happens to everything else in the book. Well, to hurry on a bit, art under those conditions, art as structure rather than as realistic record, became a probe. And I think it is a very large revolution in human affairs when art ceased to be a rearview mirror, ceased to be a mere way of recording, and became a means of probing, experimenting, trying to discover what the world is, what it's made of. Art and science joined hands with the coming of the symbolist and structural novels of the Flaubert type. Art as a probe or as a means of teaching perception is familiar in the phrase of people like Conrad, it is above all that you may see. They write in order that people may perceive what otherwise they're not going to perceive. Flaubert said, if people had read my sentimental education, there would not have been a Franco-Prussian War. And I don't think that he's exaggerating, but it means not only reading it, but perceiving what he's up to. But the this changeover from art as a sort of elitish rearview mirror game, old masters, into a probe, a scientific means of discovery, is a revolution that still rocks a lot of bandwagons and boats, and is a revolution that is felt still within the film industry as well as in the entertainment world in general. Whether or not art should be a means of discovery, or should it just be a means of wrapping oneself around with the old environment in a sort of comfortable dream world? The art of our time in its most intense moments tends toward the latter, probe, heuristic probe technique, toward prediction rather than proof and retrospect. And film is increasingly involved in these forms. Paradoxically, pop art, comic strips and so on, tend to be rather avant-garde in the sense that they are always probing new situations. I'm not talking about the storyline in them, I'm talking about their artistic mode. Pop art, popular forms of entertainment, whether in the Elizabethan period, are now, or in Dickens and Poe and Al Capp, are now regarded as serious investigations into the environment of the time. Dickens was intensely aware of the new changes in his time, as was Edgar Allan Poe. And these people only achieve artistic status when they get moved into some other culture in some other time. As soon as the Al Capps are old enough, their precious art forms, as soon Edgar Allan Poe and Dickens are regarded as absolute drivel, by the most of their contemporaries, but by the Edgar Allan Poe was regarded as a sort of artistic saint by Baudelaire, by Valéry. Move him out of his culture into another culture. Move Dickens into Russia, and he's a great man, a great artist, and so on. This creates all sorts of confusion in many people's minds. Why should a thing be junk in one culture and great art in another? It has to do with the changing patterns of perception. And so, with cowboy pictures and gangsters and Beatles, the unmistakable triumph of artistic invention and unintended greatness has come very often to American films in things like the cowboy gangster pictures, where people are free to play with their senses and get outside studios and outside movie lots and to exploit the resources of the total environment under conditions of playfulness rather than a grim artistic earnestness. The world of the Beatles in the same way is an area like Chaplin in which people put on the audience. The reason the Beatles are so powerful has nothing to do with their artistic merits in any abstract sense. It has to do with the fact that they have succeeded in putting on the audience, both in sound and in appearance. That is, the image they have created is one that has been drawn from the public. It doesn't come out of their insides at the public at all. Charlie Chaplin was an artist not because he had anything to say, but because he put on the audience. He selected certain modes of audience behavior and wore them as a mask, an artist's mask. The great entertainer, the great artist, always has that infallible power of just reaching for this bit and that bit of the public gesture and rhythm, putting it on. Well, we've gone on a long time, and I did indicate, or somebody indicated, that there might be a brief spell for questions and answers. I naturally am terrified and feel very foolish for having said that, but I'm prepared to face the music if anybody has an urgent question. Yes, sir. Sir, do you have any questions?
My question is, what do you mean by you can't have visual space interpolated into Fragonard or Boucher?
Oh, I didn't say that. Didn't say that. I would never have said such a thing. No, I'm... You are... Granted, but no, you didn't hear what I was saying at all. I have a book coming out on this subject shortly, Space in Poetry and in Painting, and in which this is properly explained. Of course, Boucher and Fragonard are intensely visual space people. Of course. All I said was that there's a great deal of that kind of visual space in Mozart, that Mozart's music uses a good deal of the Fragonard type of space. But this is entirely in terms of the sensory life, and I apologize for not having dwelt more adequately on it and more systematically, but I heard what you were reading, and you have completely misconstrued everything I've said. And I agree with, if I had said that, I would agree with you. Yes, sir. No. I am an investigator. I'm very puzzled myself. I don't seek approval. Because they have great difficulty perceiving what they ordinarily see day by day. The ordinary condition of human perceptions is incredibly anarchic. You see, we live in a world in which there are multiple languages, multiple media. We train only a little bit in one of them. The only medium in which there is any education offered in our world is writing. That is a public education. It isn't surprising, therefore, that the perceptual life of our citizens might be somewhat confused by lack of training. There is no training for the ear or the eye in the painterly or even signboard sense. Very few people know how to verbalize any facet of their environment, whatever. They don't know to what extent they are under the domination of this or that environmental influence when they're talking. But I can only suggest that confusion of an extreme kind is the normal human condition in all sensory and perceptual matters. If anybody has the idea that perception is something they do all the time, they have a tremendous shock coming when they start looking at the facts. No, perception in the sense of actual reading of the language of one's and the modes of one's environment is very rare. Only artists are trained in this skill. They develop this skill out of intense fascination with the problem, but they tend to specialize in one or another of the media. But artists are, on the whole, very skilled in perceptual matters, not concepts. They're not conceptualizers to any great degree. They are perceivers. And that's why I think they're so tremendously important to a world which is changing its environment so rapidly. It takes people long centuries to get accustomed to one environment. We have changed the environment every 10 years for a long time. A kind of volapük, a polyglot of visual and other sensory languages are being spoken all around us without our having a clue as to what they do to us. Media create environments. Environments massage and to torment the human sensorium and the psychosomatic life. They're active processes. If people think they can live tranquilly or with impunity amidst these very active processes, without noticing what's happening, then they are in trouble. And I think huge mental misery and dismay is a natural human condition today because of these rapid changes. Personally, I have no axe to grind for any one medium or any one form unless the printed word, which I am mainly involved with. But I have discovered that by paying a little attention to media, you can develop a certain amount of involvement in the actual process of that thing to the point where it becomes meaningful. It's perhaps like a surgeon who becomes fascinated by the problems of a particular operation. Quite apart from the horror, thanks to anesthesia, it is possible to perform sheer horrors of surgery upon mankind, but the fascination of involvement in the actual process can often overcome that horror. Any more questions? Yes, sir. A movie played on TV is primarily translated. It is primarily TV. It is not movie when played on TV. Now, you've been startled by seeing the TV show on TV. When you see it on TV. What tends to come through as compared with the film viewing of it? What comes through on TV to you unexpectedly? What sort of aspect appears? Yes, but you stopped too soon because you were on the verge of a very important discovery. Just become a little more attentive at those moments, because whenever you're puzzled by some phenomenon of that sort, you're on the verge of an important discovery. And don't give up. Don't be discouraged. I have no point of view in these things. I am an investigator. Yes, sir. When data, one could put it this way, when information speeds up enormously, connected narrative becomes almost impertinence compared to the need for solid patterns, gestalts. At very high speeds, well, for example, a pet word at IBM is pattern recognition. At very high speeds of data movement, the only way of coping is by pattern recognition. At low speeds, you can have narrative, yes, and connected items. Now, a newspaper page, for example, has no storyline. It has a date line. Everything on the newspaper page happens at once. There's no connection. The need is for pattern recognition and not for a connected storyline. If you try to put all the events on any newspaper page together in a sequence, in a meaningful story, you go mad. Those events occur on the newspaper page telegraphically and instantly at electric speeds, and the only possible way of coping with them is by pattern recognition, which we all do. Ah, but that, now you've heard of speed reading, haven't you? But anyway, the point about in the newspaper, if you take the date line off the page, you have a poem. Any newspaper page becomes a surrealist poem, a highly imaginative one, if you take the date line off. And this is called a happening. Thanks. Thanks very much.